Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah, good evening. This is L.A. Steele, and tonight we're going to be talking about courage, and I'm going to read a book called The Courage to Be, and that is from a theologian. And he was quite a rather famous theologian in his day, and it's from the Terry Lectures by Paul Tillich, T-I-L-L-I-C-H. And he was a professor of philosophy and theology in Union Theological Seminary. The book was published by Yale University Press, and in 1952. It's actually older than I am, but. And as far as I know, there's no other reprints of it, but it's called The Courage to Be, is the name of the book. By Paul. I'm just writing this in here so people can... sorry to be slow here tonight, I didn't mean to do that. What I'm getting at here is that what I'm going to read tonight is a book, as I said, The Courage to Be. And we're going to get into several different areas. It was quite a tremendous book. I read it a number of years ago, and I kind of were thinking about it today, what to read tonight. But let me begin with... Being in courage is the way it begins, and the first few pages, and then it goes to, and then we'll read the other another section. Each section is broken down into several other subchapters, which would be courage and fortitude from Plato to Thomas Aquinas, and it goes on. So we're going to do that tonight. So we'll begin, and. I hope you enjoy. I guarantee it'll be a little different than what you're used to. So let's go here. I'm sorry, I'm just going back to my switchboard. And a little tough when you try to do everything on your own. Without a sound engineer or a producer or everything, including the host, you tend to be a little more, how can I say, a little bit disorganized. And I'm terrible at multitasking, so if you hear a pause here and there, it's because I can't do three things at one time. Again, the chapter one here is the being in courage, it's called. In agreement with the stipulation of the Terry Foundation that the lecture shall be concerned with religion in the light of science and philosophy, I have chosen a concept in which theological, sociological, and philosophical problems converge, the concept of courage. Few concepts are as useful for the analysis of the human situation. Courage is an ethical reality. But it is rooted in the whole breadth of human existence and ultimately in the structure of being itself. It must be considered ontologically in order to be understood ethically. This becomes manifest in one of the earliest philosophical discussions of courage in Plato's dialogue Lax, L-A-C-H-E-S. In the course of the dialogue, several preliminary definitions are rejected. Then Nikas, N-I-K-I-A-S, the well-known general, tries again. As a military leader, he should know what courage is, and he should be able to define it. But his definition, like the others, proves to be inadequate. If courage, as he asserts, is the knowledge of, what is it to be dreaded, and what... and what dared, then the question tends to become universal. For in order to answer it, one must have a knowledge concerning all goods and all evils under all circumstances. But this definition contradicts the previous statements that courage is only a part of virtue. Thus, Socrates concludes, we have failed to discover what courage really is. And this failure is quite serious within the frame of Socratic thinking. According to Socrates, virtue is knowledge, and ignorance about what courage is makes any action in accordance with the true nature of courage impossible. But this Socratic failure is more important than most of the seemingly successful definitions of courage, even those of Plato himself and of Aristotle. For the failure to find a definition of courage as a virtue among other virtues reveals a basic problem of human existence. It shows that an understanding of courage presupposes an understanding of man and of his world, its structures and values. Only he who knows this knows what to affirm and what to negate. The ethical question of the nature of courage leads inescapably to the ontological question of the nature of being, and the procedure can be reversed. The ontological question of the nature of being can be asked as the ethical question of the nature of courage. Courage can show us what being is, and being can show us what courage is. Therefore, the first chapter of this book is about being and courage. Although there is no chance that I shall succeed where Socrates failed, the courage of risking an almost unavoidable failure may help to keep the Socratic problem alive. Courage and Fortitude, from Plato to Thomas Aquinas. The title of this book, The Courage to Be, unites both meaning of the concept of courage, the ethical and the ontological. Courage as a human act is a matter of valuation, is an ethical concept. Courage as the universal and essential self-affirmation of one's being is an ontological concept. Now, ontological seems to be coming up quite a bit and seems to be one of his favorite words. So therefore, what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you the exact definition of that so that we do not have ontology is the philosophical study of nature, of the nature of being, the existence or reality in general, as well as the basic categories of being and their relations, traditionally listed as a part of the major branch of philosophy known as metaphysics. And ontology deals with questions concerning what entities exist or can be said to exist, and how such entities can be grouped, related with a hierarchy, and subdivided according to similarities and differences. And now, an ontological argument is something different here. An ontological argument for the existence of God attempts the method of priori proof, which uses intuition and reason alone. In the context of Abrahamic religions, ontological arguments were first proposed by the medieval philosophers in the Book of Healing, and important variations were developed by later philosophers like Descartes and Leibniz and Norman Malcolm, Charles Hartshorne, and so on. A model logic version of the argument was devised by the mathematician Kurt Gödel. The ontological argument has been a controversial topic in philosophy. Many philosophers, including David Hume, Immanuel Kant, Bertrand Russell, have openly criticized it. Among Islamic philosophers, others have criticized the argument is varied in varied ways. And Mullah Sadra put forward a substitute argument. The argument examines the concept of God and states that if we can conceive of a greatest possible being, then it must exist. The argument is often criticized as commenting a bare assertion fallacy, as it offers no supportive premise other than qualities inherent to the unproven statement. This is also called a circular argument because the premise relies on the conclusion, which in turn relies on the premise. And the differences among the argument's principal versions arise mainly from using different concepts of God as the starting point. Anselm, for example, started with the notion of God as a being than which no greater than can be conceived, while Descartes started with the notion of God as being totally perfect, and Leibniz with something having all perfections. So basically, instead of getting into the aspects of each argument, we just understand that ontological essentially means metaphysical, and in that in that regard, we have to this is what we're dealing with. So and Mr. Tillich, being a theologian, of course, would bring this up. And this is strictly a theological book. I mean, this is not something that the average person would buy or collect. I'm going to continue with this. I think I started this already, but I... Okay. The title of the book, The Courage to Be, unites both meanings of the concept of courage, the ethical and the ontological. Courage as a human act, as a matter of valuation, is an ethical concept. Courage as the universal and essential self-affirmation of one's being is an ontological concept, or basically a metaphysical concept. The courage to be is the ethical act in which a man affirms his own being in spite of those elements of his existence which conflict with his essential self-affirmation. Looking at the history of Western thought, one finds the two meanings of courage indicated almost everywhere, explicitly or implicitly. Since we have to deal with separate chapters with the Stoic and Neo-Stoic ideas of courage, I shall restrict myself at this point to the interpretations of courage in the line of thought which leads from Plato to Thomas Aquinas. In Plato's Republic, courage is related to that element of the soul which is called thymos, the spirited, courageous element. And both are related to that level of society which is called guardians, or he says phylakes, which is Greek for guardians. And thymos lies between the intellectual and the sensual element in man. It is the unreflective striving toward what is noble. Now that's essentially the what it is. It lies between the intellectual and the sensual element in man, and it is the unreflective striving toward what is noble. As such, it has a central position in the structure of the soul. It bridges the cleavage between reason and desire. At least it could do so. Actually, the main trend of Platonic thought and the tradition of Plato's school were dualistic, emphasizing the conflict between the reasonable and the sensual. The bridge was not used. As late as Descartes and Kant, the elimination of the middle of man's being had ethical and ontological consequences. It was responsible for Kant's moral rigor and Descartes' division of being into thought and extension. The sociological context in which this development occurred is well known. The Platonic phylakes are the armed aristocracy, the representatives of what is noble and graceful, and out of them the bearers of wisdom arise and adding wisdom to courage. But this aristocracy and its values disintegrated. The latter ancient world, as well as the modern bourgeoisie, have lost them. In their place appears the bearers of enlightened reason and technically organized and directed masses. But it is remarkable that Plato himself saw the thymodes as an essential function of man's being, an ethical value and sociological quality. I'm just going to stop there because I believe, well, Plato was a liberal, all right, in many, many, many ways. And he was, I mean, for him to believe in the nobility of mankind was really quite a statement. Even though he said it was an nobility, but I believe what he was meaning and what Mr. Tillich is saying is how it evolved from that structure of the Republic, of which of course our own country is developed from, where the elite rule. But that's changing, and that's changed considerably through democracy and through the years. And I'll go on. The aristocratic element in the doctrine of courage was preserved as well as restricted by Aristotle. The motive for withstanding pain and death courageously is, according to him, that it is noble to do so and base not to do so. The courageous man acts for the sake of what is noble, for that is the aim of virtue. And that's Aristotle saying. Noble, in these and other passages, is translation of kalos and base, the translation words which usually are rendered by beautiful and ugly. A beautiful or noble deed is a deed to be praised. Courage does what it is to be praised and rejects what it is to be despised. That's interesting. Courage does what it is to be praised and rejects what it is to be despised. One praises that in which a being fulfills its potentialities or actualizes its perfections. Courage is the affirmation of one's essential nature, one's inner aim or entelechy, I don't know what that word is, but it is an affirmation which has in itself the character of in spite of. It includes the possible and, in some cases, the unavoidable sacrifice of elements which also belong to one being, but which, if not sacrificed, would prevent us from reaching our actual fulfillment. This sacrifice may include pleasure, happiness, even one's own existence. In any case, it is praiseworthy because in the act of courage, the most essential part of our being prevails against the less essential. It is the beauty and the goodness of courage that the good and the beautiful are actualized in it. Therefore, it is noble. Perfection for Aristotle, as well as for Plato, is realized in degrees, natural, personal, and social. And courage as the affirmation of one's essential being is more conspicuous in some of these degrees than in others. Since the greatest test of courage is the readiness to make the greatest sacrifice, the sacrifice of one's life, and since the soldier is required by his profession to be always ready for this sacrifice, the soldier's courage was and somehow remained the outstanding example of courage. The Greek word for courage, or manliness, and the Latin word fortudo, I mean strength, indicates the military connotation of courage. As long as the aristocracy was the group which carried arms, the aristocratic and the military connotations of courage merged. But when the aristocratic tradition disintegrated and courage could be defined as the universal knowledge of what is good and evil, wisdom and courage converged, and true courage became distinguished from the soldier's courage. And the courage of the dying Socrates was rational, democratic, not heroic, aristocratic. So when I thought that's fascinating. So the courage of the dying Socrates, who took the hemlock, you know, rather than to recant, was a rational democratic, not heroic aristocratic. So he was an everyman. Socrates was an everyman, as well as Plato was. Aristotle, a little different, but the essential elements that the Greeks understood were that they understood democracy, but they also understood the problems with democracy. And that's why Plato wrote The Republic, because he realized that there needed to be an educated and trained hierarchy, if you will, of people that could govern and could regulate and could create laws and could... But at the time, they didn't come from the masses. They came from the aristocracy. And, you know, but as that generated down, and today there is no real aristocracy, but there is an elite, and that elite is ruling the world. So, unfortunately, you know, it's more money than it is brains. Let's see where I got here. I lost my place. Perfection for Aristotle. Bear with me, folks. Sorry, when I find my place here. But the aristocratic line was revived in the early Middle Ages. Courage became again characteristic of nobility. The knight is he who represents courage as a soldier and as a nobleman. He has what was called hohi mut, the high, noble and courageous spirit. I never heard that before, but he had the high, noble and courageous spirit. The German language has two words for courageous, and I won't even attempt to say those. Tapfer originally means firm, weighty, important, pointing to the power. Mutig, which is the second word in German, is derived from mut, M-U-T. And the movement of soul suggested by the English word mood. Thus, words like hakmat and kleinmut, the heavy, the high, and the small spirit. Mut is a matter of the heart, the personal center. Therefore, mutig can be rendered as the French English courage. Is derived from the French cœur, which is heart. And while mut is preserved this larger sense, other words became more and more special virtue of the soldier, who ceased to be identical with the knight and the nobleman. It is obvious that the term mut and courage directly introduce the ontological question, while tapferkeit and fortitude in their present meanings are without such connotations. The title of these lectures could not have been The Fortitude to Be. It had to be The Courage to Be. This linguistic remarks reveal the medieval situation with respect to the concept of courage, and with it the tension between the heroic aristocratic ethics of the early Middle Ages on the one hand, and on the other hand, the rational democratic ethics, which are a heritage of the Christian humanistic tradition, and again came to the forefront at the end of the Middle Ages. This situation is classically expressed in Thomas Aquinas' Doctrine of Courage. Thomas realizes and discusses the duality in the meaning of courage. Courage is strength of mind, capable of conquering whatever threatens the attainment of the highest good. It is united with wisdom, the virtue which represents the unity of the four cardinal virtues, the two others being temperance and justice. A keen analysis could show that the four are not of equal standing. Courage united with wisdom includes temperance in relation to oneself, as well as justice in relation to others. The question then is whether courage or wisdom is the more comprehensive value, or virtue rather. The answer is dependent on the outcome of the famous discussion about the priority of intellect, or will in the essence of being, and consequently in the human personality. Since Thomas decides unambiguously for the intellect as a necessary consequence, he subordinates courage to wisdom. A decision for the priority of the will would point to a greater, though not an equal, independence of courage in its relation to wisdom. This is getting kind of like... Let me go on to the next sentence, and that'll probably clarify a little more. A decision of the priority of will would point to a greater, though not a total, dependence of courage in its relationship to wisdom. The difference between the two lines of thought is decisive for the valuation of venturing courage, in religious terms, the risk of faith. And under the dominance of wisdom, courage is essentially the strength of mind, which makes obedience to the dictates of reason or revelation possible, while venturing courage participates in the creation of wisdom. The obvious danger of the first view is uncreative stagnation, as we find in a good deal of Catholic and some rationalistic thought, while the equally obvious danger of the second view is undirected willfulness, as we find in some Protestant and much existentialist thinking. And this makes a lot more sense, because the two sides of courage is one to have. There's courage and wisdom, and the courage is the thing to stand up, for yourself, to stand up for your rights, just to understand that when you're getting slapped around, to understand when somebody else is getting beat, or understand and stand up for them, and in a righteous indignation, and at the same time, the wisdom is to know when it's most effective to strike that blow. Like, if you just go at it and say, and stand up and just say, you're wrong, you're a son of a bitch, you can't, you're blah, 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 and you attack somebody for the sake of standing up for yourself or for somebody else or whatever the circumstance may be. But the wise person, but sometimes the wise can be confused with the coward, and I've sensed that most people, that many, I don't say the majority, but I'd say 50% at least, would rather use their, what they call wisdom, to cover up their own cowardice, and or their own apathy, or their own indifference. Say, oh, it's better, it's smarter to stay out of that, smarter to stay out. Well, it's not. If you see somebody being raped in front of you, or seeing somebody being abused, or seeing somebody being insulted, or being put down, or humiliated, or for no reason, or for any reason, it's wrong. Unless that person person or that individual deserved it, then it's proper to hold back. It's not your fight. But it is your fight. It is your fight when you see oppression, when you see corruption, when you see indifference and apathy and debasement of human spirit and the body and the mind. You have to rebel. Courage insists that you rebel. Wisdom insists that you rebel. Cowardice, on the other hand, insists that you run. And insists that you rationalize. It insists that you become a non-entity in the battle of light and dark, of good and evil. And I don't think that's right. When you see an injustice being done to one, it's being done to all. And God said this. God, the Christian God, said this. You know, Christ said this. That whatever you do unto the least of my brethren, you've done unto me. So whether that be good or bad, different. But Christ wasn't one to stand and stay away from. He said, yes, give Caesar what's Caesar and give God what's God. But, hey, the smart guy would say, hey, I don't owe you the tax. Okay, I'm not going to pay it. So, fine, don't pay it. You go to jail. Okay. Well, it was Henry David Thoreau, the author of Walden, the author of Civil Disobedience. He wrote Civil Disobedience when he was jailed for not paying his poll tax. He was very upset about the Spanish-American War and the invasion of the Spanish-American War. And he said that he wouldn't pay taxes to even though it was very little money. He refused to pay it because he didn't feel that it was right that his taxes would go to pay for this war that Americans were illegally involved with. So he wrote this the Civil Disobedience, which is a classic to this day, explaining when and why it's perhaps why it is what's courageous and what's not to do. What's right and what's not to do, and when something is wrong, then you have to have, even if you're facing jail, you have to be willing to accept that. And he did. Not for very long. His mother, or his aunt, rather, got quite embarrassed that her nephew was in jail, and he, because of this, and she immediately bailed him out and paid the tax. But he, nevertheless, accepted her generosity accepted her that she was quite angry with him and went along with that, you know, and left. And then he wrote one of his greatest works, which was the Civil Disobedience. And the courage that it takes to stand in front of an army or to stand in front of armed police and not move. Violent, in a non-violent protest, if you will. It doesn't have to be violent. But in a non-violent protest takes more courage than in a violent protest. Because if you have a gun, you can shoot, you know. It doesn't take much genius to shoot. But it doesn't even take that much courage to shoot. But it sure takes a lot of courage to stand there. Somebody else is shooting or is attempting to shoot you. But again, that's where wisdom comes into play. Wisdom and intellect. You know, when is it important to do this? When is it important to stand up against oppression? Very difficult to do. And very, very difficult to do. And it has to be done in an organized, in a organized method, in an organized way to make the most effective means. Because what happens is if you stand up by yourself, look what happened. Christ got crucified. You get crucified. You get killed. You get imprisoned. And nobody gives a damn, right? Unless you're the head of the government or something, you know? But if you're just a simple citizen standing up for your rights, yeah, good luck. But if you're organized and are many citizens, like in a major rally, in a major protest, then you have the power and you have the courage. Those who have the power, and they have the courage because it's the spirit of the group to do what they're doing. And then it takes a leader of tremendous courage to convince others to create an act of civil disobedience and be threatened with jail, be threatened with beatings or torture or imprisonment. Yeah, you know, it's a frightening thing. And what is courage? It's not just standing up to somebody. It's standing up to somebody wisely and carefully, and knowing how to attack. And it's militaristic. It's a military method of madness, if you will. But nevertheless, unfortunately, you're going to always have to stand up for yourself and for somebody else someday. Now, even. And, you know, and it's not suggested that you use any kind of violent method to do so. It's all within your own spirit, you know. And courage to have faith. And he goes on with this, and let me continue. And courage is strength of mind, capable of conquering whatever threatens the attainment of the highest good. It is united with wisdom, the virtue which represents the unity of the four cardinal virtues. A keen analysis would show that the four are not of equal standing. Courage united with wisdom includes temperance in relation to oneself as well as justice in relation to others. And the question then is whether courage or wisdom is the more comprehensive virtue. The answer is dependent on the outcome of the famous decision about the priority of intellect or will in the essence of being, consequently in the human personality. Since Thomas Aquinas decides unambiguously for the intellect, the necessary consequence he subordinates courage to wisdom. A decision of the priority of the will would point to a greater, though not a total, independence of courage in its relation to wisdom. The difference between the two lines of thought is decisive for the value of venturing courage, a religious term, which means the risk of faith. And under the dominance of wisdom, courage is essentially the strength of mind, which makes obedience to the dictates of reason or revelation possible. While venturing, courage participates in the creation of wisdom. The obvious danger of the first view is uncreative stagnation, at which, in, as we find in a good deal of Catholic and some reasonable thought, I've read this already, but I wanted to re-emphasize that aspect of what we were reading tonight. However, Thomas also defends the more limited meaning of courage, which he always calls fortitudo, as a virtue besides others. As usual in these discussions, he refers to the soldier's courage as an outstanding example of a courage in the limited sense. This corresponds to the general tendency of Thomas to combine the aristocratic structure of medieval society with the universalist element of Christianity and humanism. Perfect courage is, according to Thomas, a gift of the divine spirit. I believe that too. I do believe that. Through the spirit, natural strength of mind is elevated to its supernatural perfection. This, however, means that it is united with the specifically Christian virtues, faith, hope, and love. Yeah. Well, thus a development is visible in which the ontological or metaphysical at that point side of courage is taken into faith, including hope, while the ethical side of courage is taken into love of the principles of ethics. The reception of courage into faith, especially insofar as it implies hope, appears rather early in Ambrose's doctrine of courage. He follows the ancient tradition when he calls fortitudo a loftier virtue than the rest, although it never appears alone. Courage listens to reason and carries out the intention of the mind. It is the strength of the soul to win victory in ultimate danger. But those martyrs of the Old Testament who are enumerated in Hebrews 11, courage gives consolation, patience, and experience, and becomes indistinguishable from faith and hope. In the light of this development, we can see that every attempt to define courage is confronted with these alternatives, either to use courage as the name of one virtue among others, blending the larger meaning of the word into faith and hope, or to preserve the larger meaning and interpret faith through an analysis of courage. This book follows the second alternative, partly because I believe that faith needs such a reinterpretation more than any other religious term. I want to mention an anecdotal aside. As I was reading this, I something came to my mind, an experience I had many, many years ago. Probably not that long, maybe 10, 15 years ago. I was very surprised when this happened, and it never left my mind. And I never thought that bravery or courage might have been, could be inherited, right? I always thought it was something you had, but something that you gained and you know. But I believe that courage is something that you're born with, right? Either you have it or you don't. And the reason I say that is because years ago I met this guy. I didn't like him very much for some reason. I didn't. There was something wrong about him. He seemed very skittish around me, and I don't know why I didn't do anything to cause that, but I noticed his nervousness. And his son, who was probably about two or three years old, was a little brat, you know. And he was, I can't remember, I think it was in a garage somewhere having my car done or something. And I noticed this kid who was quite a brat. He was very obnoxious little thing. But he had this attitude where he pushed you. He would push his parents and he would push anyone around him. And I he started to annoy me. I mean, he really became an annoyance in the waiting room there. He's grabbing onto my pants and, you know, throwing things around and stuff like that. I was getting ticked off. I said, you know, I'm sitting there. I got to wait half an hour for my car. I don't intend to be a babysitter to some brat. Well, the father didn't seem to care. You know, you let him do whatever you want. So I looked at the father and I said, you know, hey, look, I tell you, pal. I said, your kid is a brat. I said, you know, either straighten him out or, you know, take him outside, put him in the car. But I said, I don't want it. And the father looked at me like I was like, what do you mean he's a brat? And I said, well, can't you see? The kid's spoiled rotten. I don't know what it is, but I said, the kid's a brat. All right? I said, either cool him down, or I said, or why don't you take him outside for a walk? Or well, why don't you go outside for a walk? I said, look, I'll go outside for a walk. Why don't you and I go outside for a walk, pal? All right? And take your little mutt with you. All right? Well, you know, it got escalated. Of course, the guy didn't want to do that, and he kind of sat there and started to pout, all right? You know, a pouter. Well, then the kid started beating on my beating on the table next to me with something that I can't remember, but he started knocking things around. I was really getting annoyed, and I said, and I was the only one in the waiting room with this guy, and so I said, so I looked at the kid and I said, stop it. All of a sudden, the kid started to cry. And he went over to his father and sat down, and they both pouted for the next 20 minutes till my car was, you know, till their car was called first, I think. But whatever it was, there the father and the kid sat together pouting and almost crying because I said to stop it. Now, whether the kid learned, I mean, it looked like the father didn't have enough nerve to tell the kid to stop, nor did the kid, and of course maybe it was a learned behavior to the kid, you know, this is how dad does it, he cowers for everything, you know. But he got a little angry, and then all of a sudden he backed down and went into a pouting position, and I beat him up. All I did was tell him to stop, you know, and threaten it, and then he told me to leave. I told him, why don't you and I take a walk, pal, you know. And that was the end of that. And then he wanted to cry. So, you know, I don't know. I know other men would have said, yeah, come on, let's go out. We'll smack you around. But most guys, with any smart wisdom, any kind of sense of wisdom and courage combined, okay, or just courage, would have said, hey, kid, come over here. Knock it off, sit over here, play your game, boom, you know. You know, and that would have been it. And the kid would have come, and that would have been it. But the kid had no respect for his old man. I had no respect for his old man. And together, and I had no respect for the kid, because the kid had no, you know, had no respect at all for anybody and anything. So what I'm getting at, I guess, is that in life you run into all these different things, but there's a degree of courage that I sometimes wonder if it's inherent, if it's in your system or not. I don't know. Why do some people freak out at the slightest thing, or run and hide, or and then others rise to the occasion and become great leaders in the same crisis? Like for instance, I saw, to me it was a remarkable scene of courage tonight on one of the news programs. They were showing Haiti, and they were showing this woman who walked 8 miles to get water, all right, for her kids. She had 7 or 8 children, and she had this huge tub that she filled up and put on top of her head. They said that it was weighed about 40 or 50 pounds. This woman, tall, direct, probably in her 40s, all right, had suffered some unbelievable thing, unbelievable, all right, earthquake. And her children must have lived, but this woman was without water, without food, without shelter, without medical help, without anything. But she walked those 8 miles because she heard there was water there. She had been without water for days and days, all right, and her children were dying of thirst and hunger. And she walked. They showed her walking with that 40, 50-pound pail of water on the top of her head, bucket of water, as she was walking, probably, you know, and barefooted, too. Just tremendous resolve and courage that you could see in this woman, just in those few seconds of seeing her walking with that huge bucket on her head to go to feed her children and to give water to her kids. I mean, it was just... It was a marvel. And so and that kind of courage, man, that kind of resolve, that kind of fortitude is what the human spirit is. But the human spirit is also a coward. It's also a cowering animal, all right? If you hit it once, it runs away and cries. This is the difference between the nobility of man and the lesser of man, the ignoble, the basest, the basic primitive, cowering, fleeing, whatever, of humanity. People who will not stand up for themselves, people who will not stand up for others, people who will not stand up and allow somebody to oppress them, some disaster or some crisis to destroy them physically, mentally, you know, without coming, without any fight, without any resolve. This woman had absolutely nothing left, but she had her kids alive, and she thanked God for that, and she was going to save those kids, and she was going to save herself and bring that, walk 8 miles, okay, across barren road, dirt road, to get that water to her kids. And she was probably in the city, and she probably watched us save those kids during that. I could see it in her face. I could see it in her, in the strength, in her resolve. And that kind of courage, that is the kind of courage that must be heralded. And that's the kind of courage that man must emulate. And I believe that they do. That many, many, many people do, like the people in California who braved the floods and the fires and the landslides and the earthquakes. They still go back and they look at their burned homes or destroyed places and they say, have the resolve and say, we are going to fight this. Thank God I'm alive. And thank God my wife's alive. Thank God my kids are alive. But I'm going to fight this. And they do. They find resolve, and it's in faith, and it's in their own personal courage. And that is what we need in this country. That is what people need in this country more than ever, is that faith and that courage that you can only get. I say this with all that I am, that you can only find that courage in a divine, in God. I've never been able to find it any other way. Any kind of major disaster, I think, I mean, there isn't anybody in the world who hasn't gone through some divorce or some financial or physical crisis or something, okay, that may have devastated them, may have impoverished them, may be bankrupt, maybe you foreclosed on, maybe you lost your job, maybe your spouse passed away or your kid died or some horrible thing. But Emerson once said that what makes you these things that seem to destroy your life become the inspiration of genius. And that is true in so many ways. That's so true, because you find, as long as you have courage and strength and resolve, that you're going to get out of that hole, that crisis isn't going to kill you, because it hasn't killed you yet. It may kill you later, but it hasn't killed you yet. The fact that you're alive, breathing well, you know, maybe you've got a quarter in your pocket or a dollar left in your pocket, it's enough to make a phone call, you know, to a parent or to somebody, a friend, and say, hey, pal, I need some help. Can you lend me $10 to get you know, whatever, you know, or can, you know, whatever the case may be. But no matter how far down you are, like that poor lady with a 50-pound bucket of water filled to the capacity and dripping, you know, it was actually falling in her face as she was walking parts of it, you know, because she had filled it to the top, knowing that she might, you know, knowing have no way to carry it back other than on the top of your head, right? Walking barefoot, 8 miles, with your clothes torn, bruises on your hands and arms, probably from something that fell on you, or your house fell down, or whatever, but your children are alive. That is pure courage. And that's the courage that we must emulate. And I've only got 5 minutes left, and I've got a lot less left, but I want to, I may go into this more next week. The larger concepts of, this is courage and wisdom, is the Stoics. The larger concept of courage, which includes an ethical and ontological element, becomes immensely effective at the end of the ancient and the beginning of the modern world, in Stoicism and Neo-Stoicism. Both are philosophical schools alongside others, but both are, at the same time, more than philosophical schools. They are the way in which some of the noblest figures in later antiquity and their followers in modern times have answered the problems of existence and conquered the anxieties of fate and death. Stoicism is this sense, in this sense, is the basic religious attitude, whether it appears in theistic, atheistic, or trans-theistic forms. Therefore, it is the only real alternative to Christianity in the Western world. This is a surprising statement in the view of the fact that it was Gnosticism and Neapolitanism with which Christianity had to contend on religious philosophical grounds, and that it was the Roman Empire with which Christianity had to battle on religious political grounds. And the highly educated individualistic Stoics seem to have been not only not dangerous for the Christians, but actually willing to accept elements of Christian theism. But this is a superficial analysis. Christianity had a common basis with the religious syncretism of the ancient world, and that is the idea of descent of a divine being for the salvation of the world. In the religious movement, which centered around this idea, the anxiety of fate and death was conquered by man's participation in the divine being who had taken fate and death upon himself. Christianity, although adhering to a similar faith, was superior to syncretism in the syncretism in the individual character of the Savior Christ in its concrete historical basis in the Old Testament. Therefore, Christianity could assimilate any elements of the religious philosophical syncretism of the later ancient world without losing its historical foundation. But it could not assimilate the genuine Stoic attitude. And I'm going to finish on that note, because I think, and just state that the essence of courage, the essence of divinity, the essence of mankind, the end of our evolutionary journey is Christhood. Each man, woman, to achieve Christ. And that's what Christ was saying. That's what Christ said. Christ did not say he was divine. He said that this is how you become the perfect person. Okay? By becoming the perfect person, of course, you save yourself. You are a savior of yourself. And an example to the rest of the world, which he was, which he became. And through his remarkable tenacity, courage, and faith, he revolutionized the world and spoke to God and became the Christ, achieved Christhood, which is what our journey is. And our journey in life is to achieve that in one way or another, through ascension eventually, and through courage here on earth, and through the belief in a divine providence, that gives you the strength to achieve that unity with Christ, or that unity with God, which then you become a co-creator with God. and part of the and return to the oneness of being. At that, I'll end the story. And tonight, I'll end tonight on that note. It's now 9 o'clock. I stopped streaming. But for those of you who are hearing this on the archives, the book I was reading tonight was called The Courage to Be, and it was by Paul Tillich, T-I-L-L-I-C-H. And he was a professor of philosophy and theology, philosophical theology, and Union Theological Seminary. The book was written in 1952 and published, and there was a second printing, I believe, in 53. This is the second printing. And by Yale University Press, you might want to check that out. Tell you how old it is. You got the Library of Congress here. Library of Congress, the card number is 52-9261. 52-9261, Library of Congress catalog card number. So you might be able to find it in a library somewhere if you can go to their card number. Again, that's 52-9261. And The Courage to Be. And I highly recommend the book if you can find a copy of it. It might even be online, I don't know, some part of it. But check it out. And I will I'll end on that note. Well, thank you for everything. Thank you for being with us tonight. Hope you enjoyed the show. And tomorrow night we'll be talking with George Dixon. We'll have George Dixon with us, and we'll be talking about possible Mayan calendar, end time prophecies, and ascension consciousness. We'll have some ontological discussions or arguments, which we always seem to do, some metaphysical arguments over some issues. But nevertheless, we always have an enjoyable night with George. So please join us, Lila, myself, and George Dixon tomorrow night, right here at 8 o'clock. And have a good evening.